Astori Publishing presents A Calculated Legacy. Prologue. A late winter wind rattled the windows of Loeb House, yet the oak-paneled conference room felt almost airless. On the table lay a binder thick enough to stop a door. Stamped across its spine was a single date, March 1994, and beneath it the words, Policy Portfolio Candidates. Jack Meyer, 4 years into his post as chief of Harvard Management Company, eased the binder open and watched 12 sets of trusty eyes follow the gesture. $6.2 billion of endowment capital now waited on the judgment of a dozen people. To an outsider, an endowment sounds like a giant savings account. Inside Harvard, it functions more like a mutual fund. Each school, the law school, the divinity school, the medical school, owns pro rata units whose price rises or falls with the market. The annual income from those units keeps classrooms lit, libraries warm, and scholarships paid. This year, the distribution is projected at $275 million, roughly 4.5% of the fund's market value. Spend more than the portfolio earns after inflation and future scholars foot the bill. Spend less and current students miss opportunities that may never return. That arithmetic, simple on a chalkboard, turns philosophical when the institution is nearly 360 years old. Meyer flipped to a slide of jagged lines, returns, risks, correlations, and began translating algebra into plain English. The heart of the proposal was a policy portfolio, a long-run target mix of assets that would anchor every tactical move. Pension funds use such blueprints. Harvard never has. One column showed domestic stocks, another foreign bonds, third commodities. In the corner, a small negative sign lurked beside the word cash, signaling leverage, borrowing to own more assets than dollars on hand. Leverage is routine on Wall Street, rare on college campuses, and startling in a room where portraits of Puritan founders glare down on balance sheets. Across the table sat the university's senior corporation fellows, stewards of a AAA credit rating. That label, awarded by ratings agencies to only the soundest borrowers, grants Harvard cut-rate financing and first-call status in derivative markets. Cheap capital, however, is a double-edged sword. It magnifies gains and headlines losses. Trustee queries came quickly. What happens if emerging market equities shares traded in developing countries freeze during a political crisis? Could commodity futures backfire if oil collapses? And what of federal research dollars that once flowed freely but have begun to trickle? Every knot of uncertainty tightened around a single question. Should an educational charity embrace the tools of a hedge fund to protect its future? Meyer answered with measured cadence. A risk overlay, he said, would cap exposure. A clawback in every bonus would punish hubris. Stress tests would replay the 1987 crash on demand. Still, mathematics could not erase discomfort. The binder offered five candidate mixes from conservative to bold, yet none supplied the certainty a centuries-old institution craved. Outside, snow flurries skipped across Harvard Yard, dusting the John Harvard statue. Students hurried between lecture halls unaware that their tuition aid, their lab reagents, even their dorm radiators depended on the debate unfolding behind those closed doors. Inside, the room fell quiet as trustees leafed through graphs of efficient frontiers, curves drawn by a mean variance optimizer, a computer model that searches for the highest expected return at each level of volatility. One fellow tapped the page where the curve bent sharply upward. "Here's the frontier," he murmured, "and here's the edge." No vote was taken that afternoon. The binder went back into its slipcase. The portraits kept staring. Yet a threshold had been crossed. The idea that Harvard might borrow, trade futures, and overweight far-flung markets was no longer theoretical. It lay printed in black ink, awaiting signatures. Which path the corporation will sanction? A cautious reprise of past practice or the leveraged leap of Portfolio 5 remains undecided as the proctors extinguish the lights. What is certain is this. The choice will ripple through faculty hiring, student aid, and scientific discovery for decades, and the difference between prudence and timidity may hinge on a fraction of a percentage point in annual return. Tomorrow's meeting, set for precisely 9 a.m., promises either to reaffirm a venerable tradition or to rewrite it. The corridor outside Loeb House is silent now, but the question echoes, how daring should a university be with money meant to last forever? In this opening segment, we'll explore how a single pool of money, worth roughly $6.2 billion in March 1994, anchors Harvard University's entire financial architecture and shapes day-to-day decisions in every school. Think of that pool, the endowment, as the institutional equivalent of an engine room. If it runs smoothly, teaching, research, and campus life move forward with quiet confidence. If it falters, every deck above feels the vibration. To put this figure into perspective, $6.2 billion was approximately the GDP of a small country like Malta or Barbados in the early 1990s. Each of Harvard's separate faculties, from the medical school to the divinity school, owns pro rata units of the endowment, units that function much like shares in a mutual fund. The more units a school holds, the larger its slice of the annual distribution. For instance, if the medical school held 20% of the total units, it would receive 20% of the $275 million expected for fiscal year 1994. Because the units trade internally at market value, every dean can see in real time what a new gift or a drawdown means in dollar terms. That clarity matters. When donors restrict a gift to a particular faculty, the funds buy additional units for that faculty alone, permanently enlarging its claim on future income. Let's examine the numbers. For fiscal year 1994, the distribution flowing out of the endowment was expected to reach about $275 million, which worked out to close to 4.5% of the contemporaneous market value. To understand this ratio, consider that a 4.5% payout is akin to a homeowner having a mortgage payment that consumes 4.5% of their home's value each year, a significant outlay. Over the long sweep of history, the percentage paid out has not been fixed. It has oscillated between roughly 3.7% and 5.8%, with an average near 4.7%. What do these figures mean? They indicate that Harvard spends more when markets have been kind and reins in outflows when returns sag, yet it does so within a defined band that keeps current needs and future obligations in balance. Setting the precise dollar amount per unit is the charge of the Harvard Corporation, the university's senior governing body. Every spring, the corporation reviews the university's overall finances, weighs projected inflation, estimates faculty salary growth, gauges the rising cost of maintaining an aging physical plant, and then fixes next year's payout rate. The goal, stated in plain terms and repeated for decades, is to spend generously enough to support today's programs while still preserving, in perpetuity, the purchasing power of the endowment. This objective is not merely aspirational, it's a commitment to future generations, much like a family's trust fund. Why link the spending rule so tightly to capital market returns? Because without that linkage, distributions could drift away from economic reality. If the fund were to earn, say, only 3% after inflation, yet continue to distribute 5%, the real value of each unit would erode, leaving a smaller financial legacy for future scholars. Conversely, if the market delivered double-digit real returns and the corporation insisted on a rigidly low payout, present-day students might miss opportunities that ample resources could have funded. The oscillating band of 3.7% to 5.8% provides a shock absorber. It rises during fat years, falls during lean ones, and averages out near 4.7% over time. Here's how that looks in practice. The 1994 distribution, again, about $275 million, represented 4.5% of the $6.2 billion market value recorded that March. Deans, department chairs, and laboratory directors built their operating budgets around that inflow, secure in the knowledge that the corporation would not radically revise the number mid-year. Yet they also knew that the following spring, the payout per unit would be revisited. Because the governing philosophy demands continual recalibration to prevailing economic tides. The ability to fine-tune those economic tides is helped in no small measure by Harvard's AAA credit rating. That pristine rating lowers the cost of any debt the university might issue, and crucially for the endowment, it makes Harvard a favored counterparty in the derivative and swap markets that underlie many sophisticated investment strategies. Access to inexpensive financing is not an invitation to spend more of the endowment itself. Remember, the payout rule already dictates cash flows to the schools. But it does allow the investment office to implement cost-effective risk management trades that would be pricier for a AA or single A-rated institution. What then holds the entire framework together? Discipline. The corporation's annual process imposes discipline on spending. The unit structure imposes discipline on how gifts translate into investable assets, and the guiding principle of preserving purchasing power for future generations imposes discipline on every debate about raising or lowering the payout. Harvard may enjoy vast resources, but it treats those resources as a trust held on behalf of scholars not yet born. As we proceed to later sections, we'll delve into who actually manages those billions, how the asset mix has evolved, and why the university's risk-taking capacity is both envied and scrutinized. For now, keep three anchor points in mind. $6.2 billion of market value in March 1994, a $275 million distribution that represented 4.5% of that value, and a long-run payout range that fluctuates between 3.7% and 5.8%, averaging roughly 4.7%. Those figures form the scaffolding on which every later investment and spending decision rests. In the early 1990s, Harvard University faced a perfect storm of financial challenges. A decade-long contraction in federal support for research and education coincided with internal cost drivers. Faculty salaries were trending higher, demand for student financial aid was climbing, and an aging physical plant needed costly maintenance or renovation. These four forces, shrinking outside money, rising pay, expanding aid, and deteriorating buildings, tightened simultaneously, leaving budget officers little room to maneuver. The key numbers tell the story. Over roughly 10 years, the federal share of research funding fell from 25% to 15% of Harvard's research budget. At the same time, compensation pressure and facility costs rose enough to prompt repeated warnings from deans. Harvard's expense line was growing faster than its most dependable revenue stream. If expenses continued to outpace revenues, the university's operating deficit would balloon to $100 million by 1995, equivalent to the entire budget of the Harvard Business School. Faced with that gap, the Harvard Corporation concluded that a capital campaign in excess of $2 billion would be required simply to stabilize long-term finances. Even a record-setting fundraising drive would take years to complete, so leaders also explored whether the endowment's spending rate could inch upward without eroding its inflation-adjusted value in perpetuity. If investment returns could be enhanced by even a modest margin, a slightly higher annual distribution might ease salary, aid, and maintenance pressures in real time. That possibility thrust Harvard Management Company, the wholly owned subsidiary that runs the endowment, into the center of the financial conversation. As of 1994, HMC employed 133 people, 37 of whom were investment professionals, and ran on an annual operating budget of roughly $31 million, a fraction of the endowment's $6.2 billion value. Its formal mandate was to maximize risk-adjusted returns net of all costs. Every salary, every data terminal, and every trade ticket had to pay for itself through superior performance after adjusting for volatility. That mandate landed on the desk of Jack Meyer when he arrived in 1990. Meyer inherited an endowment that carried unusually low weights in publicly traded U.S. and foreign equities and bonds, and unusually high weights in cash plus illiquid private assets. This mix reflected historical circumstance more than strategic design and left Harvard vulnerable to under-participating in broad equity rallies while taking liquidity risk in assets that could not be sold quickly. Meyer's first response was a rigorous review of asset allocation, the university's true tolerance for risk, and the merits of an explicit structure around those long-term choices. This inquiry led him to adopt a policy portfolio, a tool familiar to many pension funds but never before used at Harvard. A policy portfolio defines a central, long-run mix of asset classes to which actual holdings will generally adhere unless a clear, temporary opportunity justifies deviation. After extensive quantitative modeling and qualitative debate, Harvard's first policy portfolio was formally adopted in 1991. The guiding philosophy was to hold a diversified spread of assets, allow only modest tactical deviations, and require persuasive evidence of market mispricing before taking a large directional position. HMC would stray only when it could make a very strong case that the market had it wrong, a hurdle that would be met only rarely. Throughout 1991 to 1994, the actual allocation stayed reasonably close to its new targets. Domestic equities were underweighted late in the interval. Real estate and commodity-related holdings ran persistently light, and cash sat slightly above policy. Most tactical adjustments were small, reflecting disciplined adherence to the long-run mix. The question remained, would this newly implemented policy portfolio deliver enough incremental return to support higher spending, quell salary pressures, satisfy financial aid needs, and refurbish aging buildings? The answer would depend on the interplay between HMC's investment strategies, the university's financial realities, and the broader economic landscape. In this segment, we'll open the hood and examine exactly how Harvard's $6.2 billion engine was tuned between 1991 and 1994, strategy by strategy, desk by desk. We will see the numbers, hear Jack Meyer's own threshold, a very strong case that the market had it wrong, and trace the invisible scaffolding of risk controls and pay incentives that kept an unusually complex machine from shaking itself apart. Start with the big picture. Once the first policy portfolio went live in 1991, Harvard Management Company, HMC, kept the actual mix remarkably close to the target grid. Domestic equities were deliberately underweighted late in the period. Real estate and commodity holdings stayed light. Cash ran a bit higher than policy. In other words, the steering wheel was held steady. Meyer made it plain that he would deviate only when HMC could present, in his words, a very strong case that the market had it wrong, and those cases arose only rarely. This disciplined approach was likely influenced by the 1987 market crash, a significant stress event that highlighted the importance of risk management. What sat beneath that calm surface was anything but simple. Within U.S. equities alone, three distinct programs operated side by side. First came a core in-house portfolio designed to shadow the Standard & Poor's 500, matching sector weights and balance sheet characteristics while relying on original company research to pick individual names. To illustrate, this core portfolio would hold stocks in proportion to their market capitalization, but HMC's analysts would select specific companies based on their own research, potentially differing from the S&P 500 index. Second, sat a parallel long-short trading book hunting relative value ideas. Warrant arbitrage, hedged closed-end fund positions, cross-ownership trades, and synthetic exposures built from options and other derivatives, all benchmarked, like the core, against the S&P 500. For instance, if HMC's analysts believed a particular stock was undervalued compared to its peers, they might buy the stock and short a corresponding amount of the S&P 500 to isolate the stock's alpha. Third, a tactical asset allocation desk used index futures and kindred derivatives to dial total market exposure up or down when macro signals flashed opportunity or risk. Combined, these three pillars produced a net domestic equity weight near 37% of total endowment assets as of early 1994. Foreign equities followed a layered architecture just as intricate. The Anchor was a large, internally managed EAFE index fund meant to deliver broad developed market beta at minimal cost. A smaller externally run mandate overlaid disciplined value screens on markets deemed less efficient and therefore more fertile. Then came two emerging market pools, one handled inside HMC, the other by an outside specialist, reflecting the view that developing country exchanges offered outsized, if volatile, return potential. Finally, an in-house foreign equity long-short desk pursued arbitrage across global cash shares, depository receipts, and equity derivatives. Each layer reported against its own benchmark, yet together they filled out the foreign stock sleeve that policy required. Bond operations were even more distinctive. The main domestic fixed income book, benchmarked to the Salomon Brothers Broad Investment Grade Index, split into trading and swap subaccounts that aggressively mined credit spreads, yield curve twists, callable bond optionality, and embedded derivatives. Here are the numbers. Gross positions routinely reached many times the $820 million net exposure that equaled roughly 13% of the endowment. To put this into perspective, if the endowment was $6.2 billion, 13% is $806 million. So the gross positions were several times this amount, indicating significant hedging and arbitrage activities. What do those figures mean? They reveal that HMC took large offsetting longs and shorts to isolate tiny mispricings rather than to swing for directional duration bets. For example, they might buy a corporate bond and short a similar treasury bond to profit from the difference in yields. High-yield bonds added another $190 million, run externally by a distressed debt specialist, familiar with bankruptcy courts and workout committees. A single in-house foreign bond portfolio mirrored the domestic playbook and carried just under $300 million of net exposure, about 4% of assets, using futures and swaps to express relative value themes across currencies and sovereign curves. Private, non-marketable holdings, roughly one quarter of the entire endowment, resided in Aeneas Management Company, HMC's wholly owned subsidiary for illiquid ventures. Venture capital dominated Aeneas's commitments. Approximately 40% of that pool financed early-stage startups, while the balance went to later-stage private equity and leveraged buyouts. To clarify, venture capital involves investing in young companies with high growth potential, often in exchange for equity. Direct investments gave Harvard equity stakes in more than 90 small companies spanning consumer products, technology, media, and medical devices. Real estate positions consisted primarily of direct equity ownership in about 20 income-producing properties, including hotels, office buildings, retail centers, and residential complexes that generated rental cash flow and offered inflation hedges. Commodity-related exposure was concentrated in private equity stakes in oil and gas enterprises, a handful of mining ventures, and a deliberately small experimental futures program whose sole aim was to outpace broad commodity indices. Measured against passive benchmarks, the lion's share of value added during the early 1990s came from four internally run long-short desks: domestic equity, foreign equity, domestic fixed income, and foreign fixed income. Observers noted that these teams looked less like traditional endowment managers and more like Wall Street proprietary trading units, but with one crucial advantage. Harvard's AAA credit rating delivered inexpensive financing and made the endowment a preferred counterparty in the very swap contracts that underpinned many of these trades. Cheap funding widened the feasible range of arbitrage spreads. Counterparties, confident in Harvard's balance sheet, were willing to write sizable contracts quickly. Such latitude demanded discipline, so HMC layered a formal risk control overlay on top of every desk. The system tracked net exposures, stress-tested portfolios against shocks reminiscent of the 1987 crash, and set hard limits designed to prevent undue relative risk from creeping in, whether markets were calm or convulsing. Positions that pushed aggregate risk outside approved corridors triggered immediate conversation and, if necessary, prompt reduction. Compensation mirrored that culture of alignment and accountability. Each internal portfolio manager received a salary plus a neutral bonus, roughly equal to that salary. The real lever was the incentive bonus, tied directly, positively or negatively, to performance against a clearly specified index. If a manager lagged, downside stopped at forfeiting the neutral bonus. If a manager outperformed, upside could reach several times base pay. Crucially, a slice of any positive award was held back and subject to clawback should future results slip. Senior officers, including Meyer himself, operated under the same framework, but their bogey was the composite return of the policy portfolio rather than a single asset class. That linkage, in management's own phrasing, created a subtle but nonetheless real incentive to keep aggregate weights near policy unless the earlier, very strong case for deviation could be made. Here's how that looks in practice. Suppose the domestic equity long-short desk spotted a mispriced convertible warrant that could be hedged against the underlying stock. The AAA rating would secure low-cost financing for the hedge. The risk overlay would confirm that the incremental exposure fit inside stress limits, and the pay system would credit or debit the manager according to how the trade performed against the S&P 500 benchmark. Every component, funding, control, incentive, clicked into place like gears in a watch, each one traceable back to the overarching promise to preserve purchasing power in perpetuity. Why is this important? Because during 1991 through 1994, all the parts had to mesh while Harvard kept domestic stocks under their policy weight, real estate and commodities on the light side, and cash slightly above the line. The internal desks still generated excess return without leaning on a booming U.S. equity market. The proof lies in contemporaneous performance data. Most internally managed portfolios beat their respective benchmarks, and small tactical tilts, underweight real estate and commodities, overweight developed and emerging foreign stocks, added supplementary gains. Risk, however, never stepped completely out of the room. The fixed income traders, for instance, carried gross positions that dwarfed the $820 million net number, had spreads snapped violently the wrong way, losses could have accumulated quickly. Similarly, the emerging market pools, which totaled roughly $270 million, $120 million external and $150 million internal, were by far the best performers in 1993 when those markets were very hot, then the worst performers in early 1994 after sentiment flipped. The risk overlay and clawback provisions existed precisely to contain such swings. Aeneas's private holdings carried their own idiosyncrasies. Illiquid stakes in more than 90 fledgling companies could not be sold at will, and the 20 properties scattered across hotels, offices, and residential complexes required periodic appraisal to peg fair value. Yet those privates still occupied about 25% of total assets, a share high by peer standards, underscoring Harvard's willingness to trade liquidity for expected long-term return. Throughout this period, cash sat a shade above policy, offering both dry powder and psychological comfort. The buffer mattered because Meyer and his team could support derivative margins, meet capital calls from venture partnerships, or pounce on dislocations without first liquidating other holdings. As the calendar approached the next formal review of policy weights, the record from 1991 through 1994 spoke clearly. Allocation discipline held, domestic equities underweight, real estate and commodities light, cash slightly high, all within narrow bands. Trading strategies proved diversified yet integrated. A three-pillar U.S. stock platform, multi-tiered foreign equity pools, a fixed income complex whose gross books ran many times the net, a measured slice of high yield, an in-house foreign bond desk, a quarter of assets in private ventures, 90-plus direct company stakes, 20 properties, commodity private equity interests, and a modest futures pilot. Value added flowed chiefly from four long-short desks, each empowered by Harvard's AAA rating, yet hemmed by a deliberate risk overlay. Finally, a redesigned pay scheme, salary, neutral bonus, incentive bonus, and clawback, aligned managers with benchmarks and kept aggregate positions moored to policy, unless, to quote Meyer one last time, the market had it wrong. All these moving parts, balanced and recalibrated daily, defined Harvard's investment engine at mid-decade. In our next segment, we'll test whether that engine, fine-tuned as it was, could handle the strategic crosswinds that emerged when the optimizer started recommending larger doses of emerging markets, commodities, and even leverage. In this segment, we'll flip the report card over and ask two intertwined questions. How good were Harvard's results in absolute terms, and how did they stack up once the university looked left and right at its competitors? Start with the bluntest metric, dollars earned. The historical record up to 1994 shows that the endowment's absolute returns over the preceding dozen years were, in the words of the internal memo, extremely good. Favorable markets certainly helped, but skill mattered too. A $6.2 billion fund does not grow briskly for 12 consecutive years on luck alone. What does that tell us? On a standalone basis, Harvard could already finance scholarships, laboratory equipment, and building repairs at a level most universities viewed with envy. Relative performance, however, tells a subtler story. Between 1989 and 1991, Harvard lagged composite benchmarks because it was overweight private assets, venture capital partnerships, direct real estate, and oil and gas properties, just as a roaring U.S. stock market left those illiquid holdings in the dust. In plain language, the university owned too many slow-moving investments during a sprint. Trustees felt that sting acutely because every newspaper headline about the Standard & Poor's 500 made the shortfall look larger. Enter Jack Meyer. By the time he had three full fiscal years under his belt, the underperformance had been reversed. Most internally managed portfolios now beat their individual benchmarks, and the endowment as a whole clawed back the ground it had lost. The turnaround did not rely on heroic all-or-nothing wagers. Instead, it rested on a series of modest evidence-based tilts that, taken together, pushed the relative line above zero. Let's walk through those tilts. First, HMC kept real estate and commodity-related holdings under their long-run policy weights. Second, it deliberately ran an overweight in both developed market foreign equities and the higher octane slice of emerging market equities. Those choices mattered because during the early 1990s, large capitalization U.S. stocks oscillated while many overseas markets, still recovering from late 80s dislocations, logged solid gains. Emerging market pools totaled roughly $270 million. $120 million parked with an external specialist, and $150 million run internally through country funds and derivatives. In the red-hot year of 1993, those holdings were by far the best performers. When sentiment cooled in early 1994, they became the worst performers. What do these figures mean? Volatility was the price of admission, but the overall contribution to Harvard's relative return remained positive once the full cycle was tallied. Meyer's approach hinged on a simple rule of thumb: deviate from policy only when Harvard could make a very strong case that the market had it wrong. By anchoring deviations in rigorous analysis and capping their size, he allowed the four in-house long-short desks, domestic equity, foreign equity, domestic fixed income, and foreign fixed income, to wring out inefficiencies without letting any single view dominate total risk. The next logical step was to hold Harvard against an external yardstick. Meyer asked staff to collect fresh data on four research-oriented universities that Harvard routinely used as peers. All four relied largely on outside money managers, including conventional firms and well-known and aggressive hedge funds. By contrast, Harvard continued to operate one of the largest in-house investment operations in academia. The peer comparison highlighted several distinctions. First, while the other universities outsourced capital to external advisors, Harvard kept control of the bulk of its assets on campus. Second, Harvard already carried a larger commitment to commodity-related assets than any of its four peers. Remember, HMC was tactically underweight commodities relative to its own policy at the time, yet even that trimmed position exceeded the policy targets of the comparison group. Why is this important? Because it underscores how asset allocation can look conservative or bold, depending on which yardstick you choose. Observers sometimes asked whether this heavy internal footprint created blind spots. HMC's answer was the incentive structure itself. Managers who underperformed forfeited their neutral bonus and watched clawback provisions nibble at prior gains, a tangible disincentive to complacency. Peer institutions leaning on outside advisors faced different constraints. They could fire a manager or redeem capital, but they could not change the fee draw after the fact. Stepping back, Harvard's performance profile by early 1994 looked like this. Absolute returns classified as extremely good, a relative dip in 1989 through 91 traced to an overweight in slow-moving private assets, and a subsequent rebound powered by diversified long-short desks plus tactical tilts toward foreign and emerging stocks and away from real estate and commodities. The peer comparison showed that Harvard kept more commodities and fewer external hedge funds than sister schools, yet still reversed its earlier slump. Imagine a fiscal year review meeting where Meyer presents two slides. Slide 1 displays a cumulative return line that climbs steadily over 12 years. Absolute success. Slide 2 overlays Harvard's relative return against a blended benchmark, dipping in 89 through 91 and climbing back above the line by 93. The takeaway for trustees is unambiguous. Harvard stumbled when its asset mix was out of sync with market leadership, adjusted course through disciplined policy plus risk-controlled tilts, and now leads most yardsticks again, all while charting a path distinct from rivals who outsource more and diversify less into real commodities. One might reasonably ask whether that recovery is durable. Meyer himself cautioned that future market regimes could punish today's winners and reward neglected corners of the portfolio. Yet he argued that the combination of a clearly articulated policy portfolio, narrow tactical ranges, and a compensation system tethered to benchmarks gave Harvard the best shot at repeating its outperformance without courting unacceptable risk. In closing, the absolute versus relative lens exposes both pride and humility. Pride because Harvard's 12-year record is numerically impressive. Humility because a 3-year relative slump showed how quickly fortunes can turn when asset weights drift too far from prevailing market currents. The lesson for the university, and by extension for any long-horizon investor, is that success hinges on a sustainable process, not a single good call. In the next part, we'll see how that process was stress-tested when a mean variance optimizer began recommending still larger doses of emerging markets, commodities, and even leverage, posing the uncomfortable question of how unconventional Harvard was willing to become in pursuit of the next incremental edge. In this section, we see how a comprehensive capital markets study forced Harvard's investment committee to confront some startling recommendations. More commodities, fewer blue-chip stocks, and even the specter of borrowing to invest. The study, ordered by Jack Meyer shortly after the start of 1994, involved compiling long-run historical data, pressure-testing them against shorter-term patterns, and comparing Harvard's views with assumptions from outside consultants like Cambridge Associates. The exercise yielded several key numerical assumptions. The real after inflation return for large capitalization U.S. equities was set at 6.5%, matching the average realized on the Standard & Poor's 500 between 1926 and 1993. Risk, measured by annualized standard deviation, was pegged at 18%, again the long-run historical figure. A small incremental return was added when considering the broader Wilshire 5000 index, which captures the well-documented small-cap premium. Developed market foreign equities were assigned the same gross return as U.S. stocks, minus explicit allowances for taxes, custody, and turnover, which total around 0.5 to 1% annually. Bonds received special treatment. Because real yields from 1950 to 1980 were deemed abnormally low, staff lifted expected real returns for both domestic and foreign bonds to align with the more generous yields visible in early 1990s markets. For example, the expected real return for domestic bonds was raised to around 4%, reflecting the prevailing market conditions. Data for real estate, venture capital, and broad commodity indices were thinner. Analysts relied on limited series, outside expert judgment, and internal consistency checks to arrive at plausible assumptions. For instance, the expected return for real estate was based on a combination of historical data and expert opinions, yielding a real return assumption of around 5%. These figures supplied the raw fuel for a mean variance optimizer that generated an efficient frontier, the set of portfolios offering the highest expected return for any chosen level of risk. The unconstrained optimizer's output was striking. At virtually every risk level, it called for hefty allocations to commodity-related assets, a significant weight in U.S. bonds, and a surprisingly large position in emerging market equities. It simultaneously relegated large-cap U.S. stocks and, until risk went sky-high, both real estate and venture capital, to smaller roles. The most aggressive solutions even featured negative cash, implying portfolio leverage. Endowments rarely borrow to invest, yet the optimizer suggested that mathematically, one could push the frontier outward by financing a portion of the portfolio. Meyer and his colleagues viewed parts of this prescription as too extreme. They imposed explicit ranges on several key asset classes: U.S. equities between 30 and 50%, emerging market equities between 5 and 15%, U.S. bonds between 10 and 30%, commodities between 5 and 15%, and cash between 0 and 10%, and re-ran the optimizer. The second pass generated a more conservative, efficient frontier whose portfolios would be more comfortable for stakeholders. Meyer noted that even this moderated output was quite sensitive to the input assumptions, and that forecasting long-run returns with precision was difficult indeed. He argued that a transparent, quantitative framework was preferable to relying on organizational consensus, which could swing abruptly with market sentiment. The debate was particularly heated over emerging market equities. Harvard already had $270 million allocated to this space, $120 million with an external specialist, and $150 million internally managed, representing about 4.4% of the endowment. The optimizer advocated for an even larger strategic weight, but staff questioned whether the model adequately captured the special risks of illiquidity, political instability, and market shutdowns common in emerging markets. For instance, the 1993 results were starkly positive, with returns exceeding 70%, but the holdings became the worst performers in early 1994 when sentiment reversed. A parallel issue arose within U.S. equities. Harvard's exposure was concentrated in large capitalization names because the S&P 500 underpins the most liquid futures and options markets, crucial for HMC's long-short style. Academic research suggested that small capitalization stocks had historically delivered higher risk-adjusted returns, and the optimizer preferred the Wilshire 5000. To achieve market cap neutrality, Harvard would need to invest roughly $500 million in new small and mid-cap positions, mostly through external managers charging reasonably expensive fees. HMC lacked the infrastructure to evaluate and monitor a broad roster of niche advisors, raising concerns about cost, complexity, and governance. Commodities emerged as a surprisingly prominent recommendation. Despite modest expected returns, their low correlation with traditional assets made them attractive diversifiers. Harvard already owned more commodity-related exposure than any of its peer institutions, yet the model urged adding more. Trustees wondered how such an expansion would be explained to stakeholders unfamiliar with the asset class. Meyer countered that diversification was precisely the point, an allocation that zigged when equities zagged could stabilize the overall portfolio. The study's findings also raised questions about leverage. Some model solutions featured negative cash balances, implying that Harvard could borrow to invest in higher return assets. While the university's AAA credit rating made financing straightforward, several trustees were uneasy about formalizing leverage as a policy tool, citing both philosophical and reputational concerns. As the committee deliberated, it became clear that each recommendation carried operational demands and political costs that numbers alone could not quantify. The optimizer provided a map, but Harvard had to navigate the terrain, rebuild infrastructure for monitoring small-cap managers, tolerate volatility in emerging markets, explain complex investments to skeptics, and justify any increased leverage. By the end of the study, the committee had a thick packet containing two efficient frontiers, detailed input assumptions, and five candidate policy portfolios spanning conservative to boldly unconventional mixes. Each portfolio came with a blank column for trustees to specify acceptable ranges, defining the latitude for tactical adjustments. Meyer leaned toward the more aggressive portfolios, arguing that Harvard's long horizon and financial strength justified calculated risk and potentially higher returns. The capital markets study had done its job, exposing trade-offs between comfort and return in a transparent, quantifiable way. As Harvard moved forward, the challenge was to balance these competing demands and decide just how unconventional it was willing to become in pursuit of perpetual purchasing power. In this segment, we'll tackle the single most jarring idea to surface from Harvard Management Company's capital markets study: running the endowment with negative cash, in plain English, borrowing money so the portfolio could hold more assets than dollars on hand. Leverage of that sort is familiar on Wall Street, but in the university world, it is almost unheard of. Endowments rarely borrow to invest, partly for philosophical reasons. Preserving intergenerational equity feels inconsistent with owing bankers a monthly coupon, and partly because most universities could not borrow cheaply even if they wanted to. Harvard, however, sits in a different zip code of credit quality, boasting a AAA rating that makes financing straightforward and lowers the interest cost of any debt it might issue. This coveted rating, earned through prudent financial management, not only reduces borrowing costs, but also makes the endowment a preferred counterparty in the swap and derivative markets that underpin many of its arbitrage trades. The optimizer, seeing that advantage and noting the low correlation between certain asset classes, simply followed the math and concluded that a modest amount of leverage would push the efficient frontier outward. In several unconstrained runs, the model produced mixes that held large doses of commodity-related assets, U.S. bonds, and emerging market equities while showing a cash balance below zero. What does that tell us? The frontier cares only about expected return, risk, and correlation. It is blind to reputation, governance, or the stomach acid produced in a trustee's gut when debt meets volatility. Jack Meyer, therefore, had to translate a sterile spreadsheet insight into a live-fire governance discussion. Could Harvard, uniquely blessed with AAA access, tolerate the reputational and risk control implications of formal leverage? Here, the institution's existing guardrails mattered. The same credit rating that supplied cheap funding also carried an embedded warning: aggressive positions could scale up quickly. To keep that speedometer in check, HMC already enforced a layered risk management architecture, performed stress tests reminiscent of the 1987 crash, and tied every manager's bonus, positively or negatively, to benchmark relative performance, with clawbacks if future results slipped. Those mechanisms stood ready to police any leverage structure, yet trustees wondered aloud whether the cultural optics of borrowing would outweigh the quantitative benefits. That conversation immediately bled into a second, equally thorny issue: should asset allocation policy be explicitly coordinated with the university's spending rule? If leverage or a heavier weighting in volatile assets raised year-to-year swings in market value, ought the payout formula be recalibrated to dampen the shock to deans planning next year's budget? Some members argued yes, noting that a more jittery asset mix could force unpleasant mid-cycle budget cuts unless distributions were smoothed. Others countered that the current generation of students and faculty faced unusually pressing needs, shrinking federal research support, rising financial aid commitments, and an aging physical plant, and might justify a temporarily higher spending rate, regardless of volatility. The record shows that the same questions had been posed in previous review cycles without resolution. By early 1994, no settled answer existed, only an uneasy truce built on annual reassessment. A third layer of complexity came from Harvard's broader balance sheet. The university owns land and facilities in Cambridge and Boston, holds valuable rare books and artworks, and has issued debt, notably to finance student housing projects. Some participants argued that these non-financial assets and liabilities should influence how much risk the endowment could prudently bear. After all, a diversified conglomerate can afford a racier investment book than a monoline entity. Others replied that campus buildings, libraries, and art collections are not fungible. They cannot be sold in a downturn to meet margin calls, and therefore sit outside any practical portfolio analysis. Against that backdrop, Meyer circulated Exhibit 13, five candidate policy portfolios labeled simply 1 through 5. Each represented a fully integrated long-run mix of asset classes consistent with the moderated optimizer: U.S. equities, foreign developed equities, emerging market equities, U.S. bonds, foreign bonds, real estate, venture capital, commodities, and cash, sometimes negative in the more adventurous mixes. He asked every HMC director and external advisor to mark the circle under the portfolio they deemed most suitable, or to pencil in an alternative of their own. On the facing page, he provided blank columns for tolerance bands, ranges within which actual weights could drift without returning to the board. The illustration was straightforward. Specify, for example, 30% U.S. equities with permission to range between 20 and 40%, or 10% commodities with a band from 5 to 15%. Those corridors would give portfolio managers tactical flexibility, yet anchor them firmly to strategic intent. Here are the numbers. Portfolio 1, the most conservative, kept leverage off the table, allotted a comparatively large slice to U.S. bonds, and held commodities near the low end of historical exposure. Portfolio 2 nudged risk higher by trimming bonds and adding a touch more emerging market equity. Portfolio 3 further increased non-traditional assets and trimmed cash close to zero. Portfolio 4 crossed the psychological Rubicon of negative cash, leverage of perhaps a few percentage points, and raised commodity and emerging market weights noticeably. Portfolio 5, the boldest, embraced leverage more openly, paired it with still larger positions in commodities and developing world equities, and in model space, offered the highest expected return per unit of risk. Why is this important? Because every incremental step from 1 to 5 asks trustees to weigh mathematical promise against institutional comfort. Meyer's own preference was clear but not dictatorial. He leaned toward portfolios 4 or 5, believing that Harvard's long investment horizon and exceptional financial strength could accommodate higher volatility in exchange for higher expected return. He further argued that those incremental returns might allow the university to distribute a slightly larger fraction of the fund each year while still preserving, in real terms, its purchasing power in perpetuity. Yet, conscious that an aggressive stance could unsettle deans, faculty, and alumni, he emphasized the need for what he called a fair consensus before endorsing any final policy. Trustees digested the proposal through multiple lenses. One recalled the early 1990s slump when Harvard was overweight illiquid private assets, just as public equities soared. Another noted that Harvard already carried a larger commitment to commodity-related assets than any of the four peer institutions studied, even though HMC was tactically underweight commodities relative to its own policy at that moment. Still, another pointed to the AAA rating. Yes, it supplied cheap leverage, but it also placed Harvard under a brighter public spotlight. Any misstep could invite instant scrutiny. the discussion circled back to the risk control overlay. With leverage in play, would existing stress tests catch the tail risks? Could the incentive system, which capped downside at forfeiting the neutral bonus, truly deter a manager from swinging for the fences with borrowed money? Management answered that aggregate risk limits would remain binding, and that any leverage would likely be modest, but the questions hung in the room. Meanwhile, finance officers from the central administration quietly modeled what a 1 percentage point rise in payout might mean for faculty salaries, financial aid, and deferred maintenance, should the aggressive portfolios deliver as advertised. Here's how the options lined up in practice. Portfolio 1 would probably leave the spending rule where it sat, roughly 4.5% of market value, recalibrated each spring. Portfolio 3 might justify creeping that figure toward the high end of historical oscillations, say 5.2 or 5.3%, provided capital market returns cooperated. Portfolios 4 or 5, if they delivered their higher expected returns, could support a payout nearer the ceiling of the long-run band. Remember, the historical range has run from about 3.7 to 5.8%, without threatening real principal, but only if volatility did not spike so much that deans demanded stabilizers in the payout formula. No vote was taken in that first round. Instead, Meyer closed the meeting by reminding participants of three facts no model could erase. Forecasting long-run returns with precision is difficult indeed. Organizational consensus can swing abruptly under the influence of greed or fear. And the stewardship mandate demands that present spending never compromise future purchasing power. The next step would be written feedback on the five portfolios, including tolerance bands, followed by a second session aimed at narrowing the field to a single policy mix that balanced mathematical efficiency with institutional self-knowledge. As the room emptied, one truth was obvious even to newcomers. Harvard's AAA rating opened doors. Cheap financing, easy derivative access, and rapid execution on arbitrage ideas. Yet, those very freedoms made disciplined policy more, not less, essential. Whether the final choice landed on portfolio 2, 4, 5, or a bespoke hybrid, the structure of risk limits, incentive pay, and annual payout governance would have to keep pace. In this final segment, we'll zoom out from the spreadsheets and trading desks to ask what Harvard's experience up to March 1994 really tells us about the power and the perils of running a $6.2 billion endowment behind a AAA balance sheet. Start with that pristine rating, a working asset that lowers financing costs and makes the endowment a preferred counterparty in derivatives markets, enabling HMC to act upon an arbitrage idea in size. The domestic fixed income book offers the clearest proof. Its managers routinely carried gross positions many times the $820 million net exposure that represented about 13% of total assets, confident that low funding costs would keep the carry positive. Similarly, the domestic equity long-short desk built synthetic exposures from options. The emerging market team hedged country funds with index futures, and Aeneas Management Company financed direct equity in over 90 small private firms, all leveraging Harvard's top-tier credit. The rating is not just a badge of honor. It is a working asset that enlarges the opportunity set every trading day by providing inexpensive financing. Yet the freedom that rating confers magnifies the downside if guardrails fail. The unconstrained mean variance optimizer produced efficient portfolios with negative cash balances, implying borrow to invest. It also pointed Harvard toward large allocations to commodity-related assets, U.S. bonds, and emerging market equities, while slashing large capitalization domestic stocks and until risk went sky high, pushing real estate and venture capital to the margins. In model space, those prescriptions raise expected return per unit of risk. But in the real world, they amplify headline risk, liquidity risk, and governance risk. Gross bond books many times net, emerging market pools that were by far the best performers in 1993 and the worst performers only months later, and private stakes that cannot be sold at will, all of these could unravel fast if leverage tightened. Harvard's own history of underperformance between 1989 and 1991, when it was overweight illiquid assets just as public equities roared, serves as a cautionary tale. That is why the risk management overlay, refined repeatedly since Jack Meyer's arrival in 1990, matters as much as asset selection. The system tracks net exposures across every desk, runs stress tests calibrated to shocks like the 1987 crash, and locks in hard limits described internally as preventing undue relative risk under either normal or stress conditions. Should a position nudge Harvard outside those corridors, trading halts for a conversation, and if numbers still refuse to fit, the position comes down. The overlay treats borrowed dollars exactly the same as owned dollars, so any future move toward formal leverage would encounter those tripwires at the planning stage, not after the fact. Incentives reinforce the guardrails through a compensation system that aligns portfolio managers' interests with Harvard's long-term goals. Each manager receives a salary, a neutral bonus equal to that salary, and an incentive bonus tied up or down to performance versus a specified benchmark. Downside stops at forfeiting the neutral bonus. Upside can reach several times base pay, but part of every positive award is held back and subject to clawback if future results lag. Senior officers, including Meyer, earn under the same framework, but are measured against the composite return of the policy portfolio, creating a subtle but nonetheless real incentive to keep aggregate weights close to plan, unless the data demonstrate that the market has it wrong. This alignment means managers share in gains when relative value trades pay off and feel tangible pain when they mistime a spread or let gross exposure creep too wide. The combination, AAA credit, disciplined risk overlay, and tightly linked pay, helped Harvard restore benchmark outperformance after the stumble of 1989 through 91. By early 1994, most internally run portfolios were beating their indices and small tactical tilts supplied a tailwind. Absolute returns over the preceding 12 years were described as extremely good, putting roughly $275 million, or about 4.5% of market value, into school budgets for fiscal year 1994. However, this success leaves an open question. Is the machine resilient enough to survive a regime in which commodities slump, emerging markets seize up, or cheap funding suddenly becomes scarce? The stakes of the upcoming asset allocation decision therefore loom large, with five candidate policy portfolios on the table. Portfolio 1 plays it safe. No leverage, an ample slice of U.S. bonds, commodities at the low end of historical exposure. Portfolio 5 stretches furthest. Formally negative cash, meaning leverage, paired with larger positions in commodities and developing world equities. Meyer leans toward portfolios 4 or 5, arguing that Harvard's long horizon and financial strength can accommodate extra volatility, and that the incremental return could justify nudging the payout ratio closer to the upper edge of its historical band, which has run from 3.7% to 5.8%, averaging about 4.7%. Trustees must now weigh that promise against reputational risk, operational complexity, and the cultural discomfort many feel with the idea of a leveraged university endowment. One administrative footnote demands attention. A repeated header in the archival material reads, "Management at Yale University from Jul 2025 to Jan 2026. The narrative, data tables, and exhibits themselves describe only Harvard's circumstances in 1994. The header is merely a usage notice carried over in formatting, not evidence that Yale was ever steering Harvard's assets. So where does that leave the world's oldest and wealthiest university? On the cusp of a choice that will signal whether it prefers the measured comfort of Portfolio 1, the calculated audacity of Portfolio 5, or a middle path that blends diversification benefits with governance pragmatism. The AAA rating, the risk control overlay, and the performance-linked pay system form a three-legged stool sturdy enough to support any of those mixes, so long as every leg remains intact. And the leverage that once magnified gains can just as quickly magnify loss. preserve all three, and Harvard may continue to outperform the same passive indices it uses to judge its own managers, not financing today's scholarships and tomorrow's laboratories, without drawing down the real value of its patrimony. Looking forward, the unanswered questions are as much philosophical as they are mathematical. Will trustees embrace a policy portfolio that favors emerging economies and tangible assets over blue-chip equities? If the optimizer's low-correlation logic holds, Harvard could ride out the next market storm with smaller drawdowns and larger long-run gains, but only if stakeholders stay calm when headlines turn red. Conversely, if comfort edges out conviction, the endowment may retain its current design, already intricate, already beating benchmarks, yet possibly leaving return on the table that generations hence will wish had been captured. Either way, the process itself, transparent inputs, published efficient frontiers, explicit tolerance bands, and pay that claws back mistakes, sets a governance standard that peers who rely on external managers and looser oversight structures will find hard to match. As the capital campaign target of in excess of $2 billion approaches and federal research dollars continue to recede, the result of this allocation vote will ripple through faculty hiring plans, student aid budgets, and building maintenance schedules for decades. In that sense, the next meeting of the Harvard Corporation is not just another agenda item. It is a referendum on how a storied institution balances prudence and ambition in the service of scholars yet unborn. And so we end where we began, with a single pool of capital owned in perpetuity by a university that must serve every present need without betraying future promise. Whether the trustees select Portfolio 1, Portfolio 5, or craft a bespoke hybrid, the outcome will write the next chapter in a narrative that has already spanned centuries. How to keep the financial engine room humming so that, far above, teaching, research, and discovery continue undimmed. The numbers on the page are fixed. The judgment about what to do with them is a living art. Harvard's decision, awaited by analysts and emulated by peers, will soon show which way the art bends this time. Thank you for choosing Astori Publishing.